Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the broader field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. Few doctrinal and political issues are more controversial in Pakistan today than that of blasphemy. In her excellent and engaging new book, Sharia and the State in Pakistan, Blasphemy Politics, Farhat Haq presents the history and present of blasphemy laws, debates, and politics in Pakistan in a manner that carefully weaves the historical backdrop of blasphemy politics with important discursive moments and contributions involving a range of different actors, state and non-state. Equally conversant with Islamic studies, South Asian studies, and political science, this book will speak to and interest multiple audiences. While familiarizing readers in eminently accessible prose with the legal, political, and theological complexities invested in the question of blasphemy in Pakistan and beyond. Throughout the book, Haq convincingly shows and argues that blasphemy politics in Pakistan escapes any neat narratives or conceptual framings, and one must attend to its contingencies in order to develop a more nuanced understanding of its thorniest implications and consequences. This book is a must-read for anyone interested in the hugely critical and controversial topic of blasphemy in Islam and in Pakistan. Here now is my conversation with Professor Farhat Haq. Hello, Farhat. How are you doing? Welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you very much, Sher Ali. I'm doing fine.
Farhat, thank you for this book, which is a splendid book, and it really speaks to multiple audiences in Islamic studies, South Asian Islam, the study of Islam in Pakistan, and about a very critical and timely topic, that of blasphemy in Pakistan. I was wondering, we have a tradition on the New Books Network, Farhat, that our first question is always biographical. So I was wondering if you could share a bit with our listeners how you became a scholar of Islam, of Pakistan and South Asia, and then what got you to write this particular book?
Yes, so I am a hyphenated American. I am a Pakistani American. I came to the United States when I was 18 years old, and then I completed my undergraduate and graduate studies here. And so as I was looking for a dissertation topic, this is in the mid-80s, political Islam was emerging as an important kind of issue for political scientists, though I would say that most of the political scientists didn't know what to do, how to study this topic, or just religion in general had not been something that political scientists had been that concerned about. Because as you well know, many of the social scientists had assumed that with modernity, religion will become less relevant. So in any event, I went looking for a topic, and I landed with this idea of writing about the Jamaat-e-Islami in Pakistan as this reformist movement who had very powerful ideas about how to organize a modern Islamic state. So I wrote that dissertation and then, of course, went searching for jobs and ended up with a job offer at Monmouth College, a small liberal arts college in Illinois, with lots of teaching opportunities teaching lots of different courses. So in any event, the first couple of years of full-time teaching didn't allow me to get back to my dissertation. And meanwhile, Professor Wali Nasser came up with a very good book on the Jamaat-Islami. And so then I felt like really at this point, I don't have the energy to do anything with my dissertation. I went on and looked at other aspects of political Islam. So I did some research on gender and Islam and wrote an article about that, looked at human rights discourse in Islam, etc. So published several articles, but I wanted to eventually sort of bring to bear my last 30 years engagement with political Islam to write this book and sort of finally felt at a place with my sabbatical few years ago that I could do that. So I took my time. It took about 3 years to really write this book, but I, you know, it just took that long to get to it.
So one of the major arguments or purposes of this book, as you put it throughout and especially in the introduction, is that you're really trying to complicate conventional, commonplace, popular understandings of blasphemy in Pakistan. I was wondering, A, could you please speak a bit about how you complicate blasphemy in Pakistan? And then if you could tie to that the central argument that you try to pursue in this project. If you could speak a bit about that. Yeah.
Sure. So I think my sort of key idea was that I see Pakistan as a really what I would call an exceptionally revealing case when it comes to looking at many of the conundrums that modern Muslim nation states face. And so I see Pakistan as a very productive case study. And then along with that, blasphemy to me became this window through which we could understand many of these complexities and conundrums, because in some ways, blasphemy really is such a the way it's been operating in Pakistan for the last 15, 20 years, this, you know, all these kind of cases around blasphemy statues. For the lack of a better word, I would say it's almost ridiculous. And by that, what I mean is it's sort of this extreme situation where almost everyone is aware that these laws are problematic, both in terms of their kind of from Islamic perspective, from secular perspective, from the perspective of delivering justice to people. But despite all of that, it's been very, very difficult for the Pakistani government. And four different governments have tried to reform these statutes, but they have not been able to. So for me, this question was why? Why is it that it's so difficult for Pakistani governments to do something that seemed otherwise let's just say, why was it so difficult for them to reform this? And so what I say then is that this the extremist kind of rhetoric of blasphemy then helps us further, it sort of shines light on some of the paradoxes that I say that Muslim politics experiences in modernity. So that's why I use these two, Pakistan and then blasphemy in Pakistan, as sort of windows into this. And so first, let me just say that, you know, the popular understanding of blasphemy laws in Pakistan and the problems they create is pretty simple, in that for most of the secular West and even secular Pakistanis, blasphemy laws are sort of an indication of intolerance of Islam, how Islam has really not gone through a reformation process, and therefore what we get is these draconian laws that are taking away people's rights. On the other hand, the other extreme is simply those who support these laws sort of saying that these are God's laws, as such they must not be reformed or changed. So these two very kind of set and very predictable ways of arguing about blasphemy. But when you actually sort of dig deeper, the first thing that one must establish is that the contemporary blasphemy laws are neither purely Islamic nor purely modern secular, that it's the entanglement of these two different traditions, the call it Sharia if you're Islamic jurisprudence, and then the more modern kind of British influenced English laws, etc. It's this very kind of complex entangling relationship between these two that really is what we have to come to terms with. I'm sorry, I'm going on, but let me just finish my, so what's my key argument? My key argument is that if you look at the all the problems that the blasphemy laws have created in Pakistan, it illuminates some conundrums that Muslims are facing in terms of accommodating Islam in public life. So the first such conundrum is that for the modern Muslim nation states, it has this sort of a paradoxical role. On the one hand, it has been now entrusted as becoming the agent which delivers Sharia or delivers Islamic jurisprudence, Islamic laws. But at the same time, I would say, dare to say, in almost all of the Muslim countries, but particularly in Pakistan, you see that Muslim states are not to be trusted. They're subject to suspicion and anxiety of the Muslim public regarding the true motivation and intentions of the governing elite. So that's one kind of paradox. The second thing that is very interesting to me is that, you know, a lot of time you see the West sort of accusing Muslim world in terms of where is your reformation, this idea that somehow Islam is sort of stuck in kind of some kind of a pre-modern rut and there has not been changes in Muslim thoughts, Muslim practices, etc., which any of us who have any knowledge of the Muslim world knows that it's completely absurd. If anything, I think the Muslim world has been in tremendous turmoil. And again, I'll talk particularly of Pakistan and South Asia when it comes to discussion and debates about what is the role of their faith in contemporary life. So what we see is this cacophony of voices in the public sphere who claim to be speaking for Islam. But at the same time, the Muslim world faces this institutional deficit when it comes to sort of creating authoritative expression of what is and is not, true to Islam or to what is the proper way of adjudicating these sort of conflicts. And so that then leads us to consequences where, on the one hand, the blasphemy law, many of the Muslim scholars, ulama, would also tell you that some aspects of the blasphemy law might be problematic, but there is no really strong institutional mechanism that could be used to sort of adjudicate finally this problem or this conflict. So the third thing that I was trying to do in this book is to sort of then think through how is it that we're going to be able to sort of create mechanisms to address some of this authority deficit, as I'm calling it. And it seemed to me that really the only way towards creating some sort of a consensus about really are there blasphemy statues in Pakistan? What kind of what should be the shape of those statues, etc., the reform, the discussion around it, that it comes through groups that have some legitimacy in the political process. Or to put it very simply, I think it is the democratic process that can eventually lead us to sort of better ways of adjudicating these conflicts. So that's the third thing I was trying to do. And part of what I note then in my book is that people or groups that have made the most hay out of the use of blasphemy statues to enhance their political influence tend to be more marginal groups, and that parties that have more of a chance to win in elections tend to be more moderate in their behavior. So that was the third thing that I was trying to get at.
Now, in one of the early chapters of the book, Farhat, you talk about these two very interesting examples, one from the 20th century, early 20th century, and then one more recently. And you mention these examples as what you call the beginning and then the sort of contemporary moment of blasphemy politics in Pakistan. These were examples of Ilmuddin in the 20th century, then Mumtaz Qadri more recently. Could you tell us a bit about these two figures, their narratives, and how they represent the beginning and contemporary point of blasphemy politics in Pakistan?
Yes. One of the kind of way of telling this story of blasphemy that I've pursued in this book is by looking at very particular figures or events and trying to tell a larger story that connects with some of the concepts that are sort of, again, the conundrums that, are shaping Muslim politics. So in this instance, in this chapter, it was what the most challenging chapter for me to write. What I was trying to do was sort of almost like take this 80 years of Ilmuddin first, who was a 19-year-old who was executed for murdering a publisher who had published a pamphlet that Muslims saw as insulting the Prophet, and that happened in 1929. And then Mumtaz Qadri, who in 2016 was executed by the state because he had assassinated the governor of Punjab. So anyway, taking between this 1929 to 2016 and sort of trying to illustrate some of the sort of ironies of what had been happening during these 80 years. So just to start with the 1929 or Ilmuddin story. So for me, that sort of, in terms of the larger concepts that I was trying to illustrate, the first such concept might be what we might call judicialization of religious differences. So the idea that you take now, you bring to law or legal sort of adjudication as an instrument for achieving your kind of sectarian or religious disputes. So this goes back then in the Indian subcontinent to the British colonial government legislating in 1860 what they called offense relating to religion. It was Lord Macaulay, of course, in 1860, who drafted these set of statutes, again calling offense relating to religion, and the idea was that India is a sort of multi-religious place, and it's best to manage these conflicts by creating these offenses, for example, to say that you cannot destroy or damage or defile any place of worship or any object held to be sacred by any class or person. But the problem, and here I'll give you a specific example to illustrate this, is that in this instance now, the state is very much implicated, the colonial state is very much implicated in defining what is and is not a religious object, for example. So one of the things, for example, was that they argued that the religious objects does not include animated objects, or so that killing a cow by a Muslim within sight of public road could not be prosecuted. This, of course, proved to be highly problematic. When in 1888, the court declared that cows were not sacred objects, the cow protection society sprung up in most parts of India. And as you know, it's until this day, one of the most highly charged symbol of Hindu nationalism. There is then that offense against religion as one of the things to think about and how that sort of judicializes religious differences. The other thing, of course, in that 80 years that I was trying to illustrate, especially in terms of the before partition 1947, the second element is the emergence of Hindu and Muslim as key national identities in the subcontinent, and what kind of politics that creates, what kind of a public sphere does it make possible. And so here then it's not only that this that the public sphere now becomes a place where your sort of religious identities are kind of contested, but also that it provides set of intense competition among Muslims, where different Muslims are jostling with each other to claim a larger part of that public sphere. And then the last thing I try to do in that chapter is to sort of then show the conundrum that the post-colonial Pakistani state faced as it tried to be first Muslim nation state, but at this and what does that mean? And at the same time, claiming to be a state that will follow sort of democratic principles of treating religious minorities as equal citizens. So let me just then get you a couple of specific examples of what I mean by this sort of. Ilmuddin's sort of killing the publisher became a highly emotional, highly charged kind of incident, and it brought to the streets many Muslim leaders, and but the leadership that it brought to the streets, especially so the kind of Islamic public sphere that it helped sort of shape, was different from you know, the way that public sphere is understood in the Western discourse. So here, I think that perhaps the most helpful expression of that has been given by the scholarship of Professor Freitag, who has sort of talked about how the public arenas in South Asia were really constituted as places that were alternative world to what the colonial government had created in terms of legitimacy. And so on the one hand, you have these colonially constructed legislative assemblies, etc., where you had quote-unquote respectable leaders of the Muslims, such as Jinnah, for example, debating this whole issue in 1927-28 regarding this insult to religious feelings. But then it's the street politics was really something that was giving opportunities to sort of newer leaders. I'll just give you example of in 1913, for example, one of the lieutenant general sort of says about one of these kind of protests that was really led by an insignificant Maulvi, insignificant cleric, but that what this shows is he worried that the future would hold the more of these kinds of protests where energetic, what he called this, I'm quoting directly, energetic, clever, ambitious, sometimes personally embittered men whose aim is to displace the natural leaders of the Muhammadian community and to become, for a time, the leaders themselves will happen. So it's so for me, then, the whole story of Ilmuddin sort of shows, yes, indeed, the public sphere does become an arena that brings on a kind of a different kind of leadership. It is, you know, part of it is the call it religious, the various Deobandis and Brailwis and Ahle Hadith, etc. And part of it is this, you know, restless young men who are looking for sort of some kind of greater engagement with the public life, and it makes that possible. Okay, so the story of Ilmuddin and Mumtaz Qadri, I think, sort of illustrates then the political dynamics in Pakistan that sort of creates this public sphere, which is, let's say, kind of okay. So that allows for ideas and actors to sort of become relevant that are other institutions are not. So the parliament, etc., some of the regular political parties are not allowing these newer actors to come into play, and that's what whether it's people in contemporary politics, for example, in Pakistan, people like Khadim Hussain Rizvi, these are ambitious leaders who don't find a space in the usual political arena, and this politics around blasphemy allows them that political space. So one last thing that I wanted to kind of illustrate with this story of Ilmuddin on the one hand and Qadri on the other hand was really the conundrum that Pakistani state faced as being the first Muslim state. So here, basically, taking off from Professor Horin Viswanathan's scholarship about blasphemy and heresy. So one of the things that she does is that she draws our attention to sort of this shifting relationship between blasphemy and heresy, or what she terms the distinction between manner and matter. So she argues that if blasphemers are defined as those who commit verbal offense in shocking, violent, crude languages, heresy is the site of competing interest and doctrine. And so the Ilmuddin story in some ways is very much about sort of blasphemy, that the publisher had been engaged in blasphemy against the prophet's honor. But in after 1947, the thing that complicates blasphemy politics is this whole question of heresy. And here it's about what constitutes a true Islam, or who is a Muslim. So within a few years of the creation of Pakistan, then the question of Ahmadis arises. And the question of Ahmadis is simply about whether or not Ahmadis accept the finality of prophethood as far as Prophet Muhammad is concerned. This, I think, provides a very sort of, it becomes very tricky then for Pakistani state to both kind of construct a modern Islam Muslim identity and also be attuned to the rights of the minority. So unlike the British state that could take its Christian heritage for granted, while burnishing its credentials as a liberal constitutional polity, the Pakistani state first had to construct an identity as the first Muslim nation state, and then also at the same time think about how to create sort of equal rights for all its citizens, including religious minorities. So what I argue is that this whole Ahmadi question very quickly in the early 50s in Pakistan became this explosive sort of a collision between blasphemy and heresy. And as a result, what you sort of see is the Pakistani state initially sort of seeing this as only kind of intolerance of these various, Maulavis or religious clerics. And so there was a commission formulated in Pakistan called Munir Kayani Commission that wanted to look at what had led to all these rioting around the Ahmadi question. Unfortunately, one of the things that they came up with in their commission report was to sort of say, look, all these religious clerics, they cannot agree on who is a Muslim. So in a sense, they were sort of saying that, the ulama are just too wedded to their own particular differences, and they really are not quite capable of performing any kind of a role for in a modern polity. They are, too backward, etc. But one of the things that the commission does recommend is that maybe we should come up with a definition of who's a Muslim. And I argue that created a whole can of worms, and it really led to a lot of the difficulties that we saw later on, because it was sort of asking for trouble to sort of say that there should be a legally defined definition of who is a Muslim. And we can see that later on playing into 70s, into sort of declaring Ahmadis and non-Muslims. So all of these, as you can see, very complex strands, I try to sort of knit them into in a narrative that explains to us why is it that blasphemy politics became such a conundrum, such a hard nut to crack in Pakistan.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This serves as a good segue into the next question, Farhat. We've already begun to touch on this, but you know, one of the big strengths of this book is that you really go into some great detail into some key moments and developments that go into the formations of blasphemy laws in Pakistan. So building on what you were just talking about in relation to the question of the Ahmadiyya community, could you maybe speak to some more pivotal moments and developments and paradoxes that have shaped the genealogy of blasphemy laws in Pakistan?
Sure, absolutely. So one of the things that many others have noted is the fact that the blasphemy statutes, as they were put together in terms of offense against religion, had been on the books for a long time in both India and Pakistan. They continued even after partition. But it was really, they did not create much controversy, or not too many cases came out of those statues. So the question then becomes, why is it that it's really more in the late 80s and really 1990s onward, the last 25, 30 years, that these statues had become, I think, sort of a factory for generating sort of religious conflict and creating all the trouble that we usually associate with blasphemy statues. So why is it that they become so controversial in the 1990s and they were not so earlier? So to answer that question, first of all, we have to see how blasphemy statutes were expanded in early 80s. That takes us to the story of, I think, for me, again, a general phenomena, but I focus on the case of Pakistan, how authoritarian governments have used Islam for purpose of legitimizing their rule. So as you know, Ziaul-Haq, who was a military dictator, who had hung the first popularly elected prime minister of Pakistan, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, and taken over, then engaged in what was known as Islamicization and had passed a variety of statutes and executive orders to implement Islam, as he explained it. So during that time then, we see blasphemy statutes being expanded. So the very first expansion happened in 1980. It was called 298A of Pakistan Penal Code. And I think it's important for me to just read you that the few sentences of that law. So it says, whoever by words, either spoken or written, or by visible representations, or by any imputation, innuendo, or insinuation, directly or indirectly defiles the sacred name of any wife, Ummul Momineen, on members of the family, Ahle Bayt, of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, or any of the righteous Khalifs, Khulafa'i Rashideen, or companions, Sahaba, of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, shall be punished with imprisonment of either description for a term which may extend to 3 years, or with fine, or with both. Okay, so anyone who is aware of the Shia Sunni sort of sectarian landscape of South Asia would see that this is really something that is targeted against the Shia, and it can create lots of issues in terms of again becoming a statute that can generate hundreds, if not thousands, of cases where Shia might be accused of violating this code because in their commemorations, they say things that will be seen as insulting Prophet's family. So the question is, why this change at this point? And so what I try to kind of show in my a book is that Ziaul Haq had implemented the Zakat and Ush ordinance, which sort of said that from then on, Muslims will pay Zakat to the state. That was opposed by the Shia because they argued that they follow a different, the Jafriya school of jurisprudence, and therefore they will not follow the Hanafis, which is the main jurisprudential school to be followed by the Sunni in Pakistan. And that created tremendous controversy. And I show how, you know, the Pakistani government sort of solicited opinion from the Iranian government. They got a lot of pressure from the Saudi government to actually implement this, you know. So Pakistani then politics became highly sectarian during after this whole Zakat and Ush ordinance controversy, and it then spawned multiple groups, Shia Sunni groups that we might call extremists, that were then kind of became militarized and started to use the public arena for that sectarian politics. And so this particular statute, the extension of this 295A, then you can see is very much used as a weapon by one particular sect against another, so to speak. So the other just additions into the blasphemy statutes then in 1982, the ordinance was modified once again. And this time, the British already had this, that if you injure or defy a place of worship with intent to insult a religion, that will be considered an offense. But in this instance, what was added was defiling the Quran, that if you defile the Quran, then you will be punished under the statute. Here again, unfortunately, what we see is what Asad Ahmed has called moral panic, because there were a series of stories in the newspaper reporting instances of defilement of Quran. But really, as you can see, that the Quranic text is now widely available in a lot of newspapers, books, etc. And so what happened a lot of time is that some pieces of it might go into rubbish or become part of sewage or something, and because the vast majority of the cleaners and sewage workers are illiterate Christians in Pakistan, sometime unknowingly they might dispose of paper that had the Quranic verses on it without necessarily knowing what it is that they're doing. But that then became yet another a place where many of the Christians were accused of blasphemy because they were supposedly defiling the Quran, and it became a source of tremendous problem around blasphemy statute. The third edition was in 1984, and that was to prohibit Ahmadis from posing as Muslims, which creates a whole lot of problem that, you know, I don't unfortunately have time to go into. And then the last edition was in 1986. It was 295C, which prohibited use of derogatory marks remarks against the prophet. So it was known as a statue for the protection of honor of prophet Namus-e Muhammad. And this is the one that then generated a lot of other cases, some of the most famous one being the assassination of the governor, Taseer, in 2011.
Now, another big strength of this book, Farhat, is that you also bring into view many actors that we might previously had not known about, and you show their critical importance to the development of blasphemy in Pakistan. And one such figure who really intrigued me in one of the middle chapters of the book is this figure called Muhammad Ismail Qureshi. Could you introduce this figure to our listeners and describe a bit his important role in the development of blasphemy discourse in Pakistan, and how does he really embody some of the tensions and aspirations of blasphemy politics in Pakistan?
Yes, absolutely. I think Muhammad Ismail Qureshi is really a great illustration of these various strands that come together to sort of shape our thinking about, excuse me. Let me start that over again. Okay, so Muhammad Ismail Qureshi, he is one of the pivotal figures in the movement that is known as Khatam-e-Nubuwwat, or the movement that declares Muhammad as the final prophet, and that's a movement that's geared against the Ahmadis. And the second is called Namus-e-Risalat movement, and that's to protect the honor of the prophet, very much related then to the blasphemy statues. So he's an attorney trained in sort of modern laws. He's not an alim. He's not a scholar of Islamic laws. But he's been a very pivotal figure in blasphemy statutes because he has argued in front of the Supreme Court's Shariat appellate bench in favor of declaring Ahmadis as non-Muslims, for example. He's also been one of the pivotal figures that have argued that the only punishment for blasphemy, insulting the prophet, is death penalty, and has successfully argued that, by the way, in front of the Pakistani Supreme Court. So, you know, who is this figure, and why does he have such an influence on this issue? I think that when you read his book, which I sort of discussed in my book, it's called Namus-e-Risalat or Kanoon-e-Tohin-e-Risalat, the Prophet's and honor and the laws around insulting the prophet. What I find is that he is really a good example of how you could take from the Islamic past, which was so much more pluralistic and sort of, you know, tolerant of differences, etc., how you can take a few import from that past, a few concepts, and then sort of mix them into the Western legal tradition and come up with a very, very rigid framework. This is what, which then sort of says that, you know, the statutes are God's laws. So he's a good example of how that happens, a recipe of how that happens. So, for example, he sort of says, okay, among the Muslims, there had been all this debate between the four different schools of laws and throughout Muslim history about what constitutes blasphemy. And so since there's no such thing as blasphemy as such in the Islamic jurisprudence, there are several things that can be similar to what we understand as blasphemy. So one of the things, for example, is called irtad, where if Muslims can potentially say such insulting things about the prophet that they can no longer claim to be Muslims. So that's like, you know, one way you can leave the faith or become an apostate. But then there is all this debate about, okay, what then if that's the case, then what's the penalty for that? Should the penalty of that be death, or should we just leave it to the afterlife and for God to decide how how this person should be punished. There's a lot of debate about what about women. There is some, I think, among the Hanafi disagreement that women should not be put to death in the this punishment for insulting the Prophet. Anyway, so there's a lot of this debate. So he basically goes through all of them and essentially comes up with this idea that really, at the end of it, there is no debate, that it is all, there is tremendous consensus that all of these acts should be punished with death penalty. So this whole idea of creating a very rigid framework. But he does that by really importing then some of the Western concept. So sort of he makes this argument, for example, that insulting the Prophet is really like becoming a rebel against the state. And since Islam is an important part of Pakistani state, if you're insulting the Prophet, you are really rebelling against the state, and all countries punish rebels against the state through death penalty. So you can see how he is sort of this, you know, kind of mixing of matching of different traditions to just come up with a very rigid framework.
Now, one of the things that you argue throughout this book, which I think is a central theme, is this very poignant argument where you say that the narrative of blasphemy in Pakistan, and I'm sort of paraphrasing your argument here, shows how Islam has been secularized and the state sacralized in the country, which I thought was a very interesting formulation. Could you explain a bit this argument for our listeners?
Yes. So I think first I would just say that, you know, as both a scholar who tried to kind of understand political Islam, but also as a Pakistani American who goes to Pakistan all the times, and, you know, this is a joke, but it's true. A lot of my best friends are Muslims. I mean, I sort of understand kind of the practice of it, daily practice of Islam. And so for me, it's this tremendous gap sometime between the fact that for many of the Muslims, you know, religion is very important, and it is sort of guides their daily life, and they try to be a good person because they want to be a good Muslim. But then I look at the political framework, particularly in Pakistan, and I see how often Islamic ideas are used in a way to create outcomes that really are even morally morally apprehensible. They are like, you know, the outcomes like that really question our moral conscience. So part of my writing this book was trying to sort of come to terms with what is going on with that gap. Why is there this gap? And so for me, the answer has to do first with the fact that for the Muslims in modernity, state has become the key focus that kind of defines how to live a good Muslim life, which I find problematic. So this focus on the state as the primary expression of Islam, but as I said earlier, it's at the same time there is a deep suspicion of the motivation of political elites and anxiety over the political use of Islam among Muslims. So this paradoxical sort of situation then creates these kind of ironies, I would say. So, for example, you know, on the one hand, if you ask Muslims, and I've asked a lot of my Pakistani friends, they would say, absolutely, Pakistani state should, as an Islamic state, implement the Zakat ordinance. But on the other hand, I see many of those people finding all kinds of ways to get out of paying Zakat to the state. And so my kind of challenge was to understand why that happens. So one of the things that, again, my reading about, Islamic studies particularly sort of illustrated to me is that the implementation of Islamic laws in pre-modern Sharia were based on this idea of the activation of person's conscious, zamir, to tell the truth. So the idea was, even if you gain advantage in this world by lying, you would have to account for that lying hereafter. So the Islamic way of life, or Sharia, was not simply about Islamic way and laws. It was also understood to be ethical, legal, social framework that contained techniques to produce moral sensibility and to adjudicate social conflicts. It worked. It was a workable framework. And so this is what we lose in modern times, because the way that Islamic laws are implemented in contemporary Muslim societies sort of breaks the ethical foundation of these laws. So yes, so you know, if you took, for example, the whole notion of hudud laws, right? So in the 1980s in Pakistan, hudud laws become infamous for violating women's rights. So you know, one of the stories that was told so many different times was this idea of a poor blind woman, Safia Bibi, who was raped by one of the bosses of hers where she worked. She became pregnant, and then she was the one who was accused of engaging in zina or non-marital sex and was imprisoned. So again, that story really, sort of challenges our conscience about the justness of Islamic laws. But my kind of readings of the Hudud Ordinance, or Hudud as a set of Islamic punishment, showed me that, in fact, these were some of the most difficult laws to implement, that there was greatest benefit given to the accused, that there was the idea that, you know, these are indeed crimes against God, and so therefore they should be punished. This is hard, but it's better to let some of the people who actually might be guilty free, because you want to make sure that they have all the guarantees. And so, because there's always, God can always punish them in hereafter. So this idea of, kind of really careful implementation. That's why we see that for the longest stretch of Islamic history, we did not have people who were accused of adultery being stoned, etc. So that for me, as a secular Muslim, should I say, was a discovery. It was something, a revelation for me. And so, given all of that, what I say, my argument is that the fact that authoritarian countries or authoritarian leaders like Ziaul Haq in Pakistan or Numeri in Sudan implemented these hudud laws as a way to really both enhance their legitimacy and also to somewhat create a sort of terror among their opponents sort of shows the kind of, I guess, this secularization of these Islamic laws. That's part of what I mean by that.
Terrific. Now, towards the end of your book, Farhat, you also bring in a comparative angle to this whole study of blasphemy in Pakistan. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about how some of the prevailing discourses and laws on blasphemy in Pakistan compare to what we find in other Muslim majority countries. Maybe you can pick a couple to give this comparative angle that you bring towards the end of the book.
Okay, let me very quickly actually give you, there were four countries that I looked at as a comparison. So first, let's look at Turkey, because I think Turkey is a very interesting example for us in the Muslim world. So in Turkey, there is really no, in terms of blasphemy laws, no laws that kind of... let me start that over again. I'm sorry. I don't know why I'm having such a trouble. Okay, let me start that over again. Okay. So in Turkey, what we see is that the decades of sort of very assertive state control over religion, and also, as you know, there was a very strong secularist project in Turkey, meant that there really are no blasphemy or apostasy statutes that Turkey has. It does have Article 216 in their penal code, which is sort of not, it's against insulting people's religion. So any person openly disrespectful to the religious belief of a group is punishment with imprisonment of 6 months or so, or 1 year. So it's really a more sort of a liberal expression of making sure that you're not engaging in, insult of other people's religious feeling. I think Turkey, I would say this in a very sort of a careful way, but maybe one kind of a model for sort of thinking about contemporary Muslim politics, because in many ways they have now sort of come to a term where the Sharia in Turkey is not equated with specific Islamic laws. Instead, it is viewed more as a system of kind of moral actions or ethical guidelines. So that's one model. Then Egypt is a very, again, a very interesting case, because there are several different issues that touch on this whole idea of blasphemy. So there is this idea of what is the status of Baha'i in Egypt. There's also issues around Coptic Christians, for example, because there is no divorce allowed in Coptic Christianity. So there have been instances where Coptic men have converted to Islam as a way to sort of get divorced, but then they want to go back to their fold of, reconvert back to Christianity, and that created all kinds of issues around irtad or leaving Islam. Can you be allowed to leave Islam? And there's also a very famous case in Egypt of Abu Zayyad, who's really an Islamic reformer, and his writing was used as a basis by some of his opponents to say that he's actually left the fold of Islam. So there are many different interesting cases in Egypt. I think I would recommend to your listener Saba Mahmood's book, Religious Differences in a Secular Age, where she does a marvelous job of examining many of these issues in Egypt. Then just let me get to Indonesia very quickly, because Indonesia is another interesting case. First of all, the largest Muslim country in the world, but also highly pluralistic. So, there are 87% of the Indonesians are Muslims, but then they have, Hindus, Christians, Buddhists, etc. And the way the modern Indonesian state has managed religious differences is what Jeremy Menchkin has described as productive intolerance. So the idea is that a belief in one God is an important part of being an Indonesian national identity. That means that the six religions that are officially recognized in Indonesia ought all to be treated equally. So that's what recognition of religious pluralism. But what is interesting in Indonesia is this fear of heresy or heterodoxy. That's where there is lots of, sort of controversy that we see. For example, in 2005, the Council of Indonesian Ulama announced that the biggest problem facing Indonesia is heresy. And as a result, then there have been lots of cases brought against the Ahmadis. And interestingly, even the Shia have been sort of enfolded into this idea of heresy, that really Shiism cannot be allowed as a practice in Indonesia because they're heretical. So there's all those sort of issues that are at play in Indonesia. Very quickly, I think Tunisia is maybe another model of a kind, because in Tunisia, as you know, it's one of the bright spots coming out of the Arab Spring, the variety of protests, etc., that happened in that Indonesia. Tunisia is the only country that has sort of emerged out of Arab Spring and have continued to keep its democratic form. And here, I think just one interesting thing to outline is that the Ennahda party, which is the Islamist party that was came to power out of elections and wrote the first Tunisian constitution, says the following. I just want to it guarantees. The constitution guarantees freedom of conscience and belief, free exercise of religious practices, and neutrality of mosque and places of worship from all partisan instrumentalization. So that's sort of an interesting kind of expression, where they're trying to create a balance between, on the one hand, kind of freedom of expression, but on the other hand, also trying to kind of recognize that Islam is an important part of Tunisian identity. And so there is that case.
As we're coming to the end of our time, Farhad, could you share with our listeners a bit about what you might be thinking about as the next project that you will be working on?
Sure. So my next project, I'm really interested in thinking about gender in contemporary Muslim countries, and particularly in Pakistan. Again, as a Muslim woman, I find that there is just so much confusion and big political projects around the role of Muslim women in contemporary politics. And so what I want to do is, again, as I try to do in this book, I want to look at very specific set of cases and then see how that illustrates to us this larger dynamic of what's going on with Muslim women's role in contemporary Muslim politics. So what I'm going to do is study a law that was made by the Punjab Assembly in 2015 called Violence Against Women, and then they created a center that is supposed to help implement that. So I'm going to sort of do a participant observation kind of study there, hoping to do that next year, and then see what that illustrates to me in terms of this whole notion of Muslim women and their roles.
Sharia and the State in Pakistan, Blasphemy Politics by Professor Farhad Haque, published by Routledge Press in 2019. Thank you so much, Farhad, for such a rich and engaging book. Really looking forward to the conversations that it will spark. And thank you so much for the generosity of your time today in speaking to us on the New Books Network. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Shirali, for giving me the opportunity. Take care.
So this was my conversation with Professor Farhad Haque about her wonderful new book on blasphemy politics in Pakistan. I hope you enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you will join us next week for another new episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.